really want to know and you can't explain, so I can't feel safe. I can hear my aunt's voice telling me that if my security depends on a man's words or action, I've lost sight of my power. I feel like I become worse the more I know you love me. We are both worse for loving each other, it seems. It can get better. Descending to ascend, they call it. Everything feels ugly, and we are only at 3 months gestation. I plan for a trip to my low residency program in Santa Fe. We sent Isaiah alone on a flight to stay with Vito and Isidore for the weeks I'll be at IAIA. I searched your computer and saw that you told Lilis that the world was better with her in it, while I was in the hospital with brochures about my potential disorders. You had never told me before that the world was better with me in it, and I wouldn't have believed it either. I found a conversation between you and Lily, where she asked what happened between you and me. You said I was a cool girl, but it was just over. You were still fucking me, though. You asked her if she wanted to hang out, not in a lecherous way. You are a great friend to women. She told you that she had a problem with a man. You told her you were a good listener. Then, every Sunday, even after you and I made the commitment to a new fidelity, Lily goes to your house at night to smoke weed and watch TV. I learned, through the transcripts of your conversation, that moments after my son and I left your house, she was with you. I could not stop obsessing. I explained to my friends that I don't think you slept with her. The strange thing is they believed me. I guess I was convincing. The knowledge proposes I either start each day as new and take you for your word, or I tear the walls down to illustrate my pain. I feel pregnant with burden, and I chose it. I want to take it back. I broke every glass. I broke windows. I threw out your possessions. You didn't apologize. You explained what a friendship is. You explained that while she asked to cuddle you, you didn't proposition her. The only thing socioeconomically, practically, or rationally I can do is ask if you could abstain from speaking to her again. The next day I looked at the wreckage of our home. You forgave me with the resignation I saw in your face. It had rained and your chess pieces were already buried in the soil of our backyard. We drove to Santa Fe, aware of my fragile state. You gave me your phone to look up directions in the middle of our long drive. Instead, I saw messages you sent to your Laura. She wanted to see you months back. You explained to her that you would stop by after you visited your ex-girlfriend in the hospital, me. And to my surprise, you told her that you missed the smell of her on your pillow, the thing you told me the first nights we were together. The first night you ever cooked for me, probably the way you cooked for her, you told me you loved me. I believed, after seeing how familiar you were with her, that your love was a slimy reproduction. While I cried, while you drove, I punched you. You didn't swerve, but you held your eye with one hand. I cried over your reprimands. I cried over your shock for hours until we arrived at the hotel. Because I can function in the external world, I showered and went to my first workshop at school. You drove me because you feared I would hurt myself. You followed me in because I asked you. It was an Indian renaissance. Somehow it was more Indian with you there behind me with a black eye. Somehow it was more Indian because I was pregnant. There was a medicine wheel in the academic building, so large and proud to be Indian that I knew I was home. There were Indian writers, and we smiled at each other, as if this was a sovereign land and we belonged. You were a bystander to my joy. You had a black eye, and we covered it with excuses. It was then I realized I was partly my father. I hurt you because I felt justified. You deserve a body without violation. At residency, you did harmless things. When I came out of my first workshop, you were talking to a woman, a memoirist who wrote about being a dominatrix. When I approached you both, you immediately introduced me. She asked you for your full name. She did not ask me for mine. When we got home, she had already sent you a request to be friends on social media. This is what writers do. They network, you said. That night, my brother told me on the phone that Indian women were crazy and white men never expect it. He told me I was not my father. We lamented together about the past. He explained that my father was much worse than punches. Our father didn't like our brother, Guy Wio, the oldest brother from another father, our protector. He often punished Guy Wio by pulling him into a room and locking the door behind them. We all have problems from that time. Problems I forget. We wet the bed as toddlers and children. I couldn't go to people's homes because of my accidents. The problem followed me into the third grade. None of us attended school frequently. All of us had substance abuse problems, which are still welcome over the very sober pain of remembering. Ovilla told me that he doesn't know what our father did to Guy. We lamented about Isidore. When Isidore was taken away, I often held newborn Isaiah incapable of looking at him. We managed to piece together a night I took a bottle of aspirin, thinking I could kill myself. I told him that in my sleep, I reached my arm over to pull Isidore closer to me in bed, and he was not there. I was terrified in the dark, searching with both hands to find my son. It took moments, maybe minutes, for me to realize that he was gone. He had been taken away. I walked into the living room, and Ovi was sitting down, holding a cup of tea. I didn't want to burden him with my pain. I think I forgot that Isaiah was even in his crib asleep. My pain was selfish. I went into the bathroom and swallowed a bottle of aspirin. It was funny then, somehow, because Mom had only died several months before. Her douche and hair dye and tweezers were still in the bathroom. I had to search through her things to find the bottle. I told Ovi what I did, and he laughed at me. He said that I should go and barf, because aspirin isn't fatal. He went to get me water, and before he could return, I ran to the bathroom and made it to the sink. I threw up slimy, smaller white pills. I had to hold myself against the walls to return to bed. My stomach hurt so much. My C-section scar ached. I laid down on my back, and he opened my door. He sat down and observed me. He smiled as I groaned. "Do you need an aspirin?" he said. It was the most painful laugh. I remembered my new baby in the crib, who slept every night like clockwork, like a gift. Ovilla nursed me to health, and I nursed my baby. He made barbecue ribs and bought me pastries and served me orange juice. We had never had a relationship where either of us showed affection. He nursed me back into motherhood. He nursed me back into leaving the house and taking adult education classes. When I realized the reservation was an insufficient place to learn, he let me leave without argument or concern. I drank your beer in the hotel room in Santa Fe. You literally waited on the other side of the door for me. When I opened it, I had to face that I was part monster. I cried, and you didn't ask me to apologize. You didn't direct attention to the broken vessels on your face, the large black eye. The next day at school, I was pale from not sleeping and sick of myself. After the residency, when we got home, I drove to a parking lot and called an abortion clinic. They immediately allowed me to speak with a doctor. I explained the situation. I am violent. I have hit myself in the face to cope with worthlessness. I hit you, and I wanted to die. I wanted to take pills I still had from before I was pregnant. Also, I want to live. The doctor said she was confident that given my circumstance, a late-term abortion would be considered necessary. I asked her for the price, and she directed me to the receptionist. It was roughly $400 if, after consultation, it was approved. I called you to ask for the money, and instead, you pled for the baby's life. I hung up. I was familiar with the baby's life, but I couldn't think of that. I made more calls to foundations for women, clinics, groups, and then called back the same doctor. I was willing to sell my car or anything to have sanity again. When does my baby have bones? I asked. This is something we should talk about in the consultation, the woman said. I knew immediately that the thunder being inside of me had good bones. I thought of the bones from my lineage, which had been cemented inside the walls of residential buildings. I thought of my ancestors. I hung up and drove home. In the next weeks, our baby in my womb reminded me of my brother Guy Wio, willful and scared. He kicked before the doctors predicted he would. He hiccuped each night at 11. I believe my mother spoke to our baby in my sleep. I think they devised a way to punish me for even thinking that a thunder being inside of me could be bad. For 100 days, I vomited. The projection of solids from my body felt like baby Guy was crawling out of my throat. I heaved until my face became blotchy. We believed it was an allergic reaction, but our doctor said it was blood vessels bursting from the strain of puking so often and so hard. No pill worked against the nausea. I realized, after looking at my silhouette, seeing our small person expanding my reflection, that pain didn't burden me. Trying to forget damaged me the most. Your eye has long since healed. I chose to be lethargic instead of angry in the last months of our pregnancy. Each night, I rested my head in your lap, and you placed your hand on my stomach. He kicked you, and I felt my mother raising her hands to me in the way Salish women do in ceremony to say thank you. When the day came, I wasn't sure I was in pain enough, because the baby had conditioned me so well. We went into the hospital anyway, and Casey Gaiwio was cut out from me, larger than he should have been. His skin is milk, and his body feels electric and unforgiving. He seems like the child my brothers, my sister, and I could have been. 6. I know I'll go. I preferred abandoned over forsaken, and estranged to abandoned. I loved with abandon. It's something I still take with me. Estranged is a word with a focus on absence. I can't afford to think of lack. I'd rather be liberated by it. Coffee cups run cold when I remember my father. Sometimes my hands shake. My father died at the Thunderbird Hotel on Flood Hope Road. According to documents, he was beaten over a prostitute or a cigarette. I prefer to tell people it was over a cigarette. I considered an Indian death myself, while walking along the country roads of my reservation, before I really considered life. His death intruded as I could not fathom being a good person when I came from such misery. I found newspaper clips about my father. Ken and 4 men abducted a girl. There aren't any details. There are documents about his murder and the transitional housing program he was in when he died. He was homeless, and social welfare gave him a hotel room, next to prostitutes and younger, more violent men. There was nothing easy about his memory or what he left behind. He was an anomaly, a drunk savant. He took his colors, brushes, and stool when he left my mother. It was harvest, and the corn stalks were gold and waving. I was constantly waiting outside on the porch. I ate blueberries and spit out anything too ripe, a purple liquid. I remember staring at my spit on the porch, wondering about waste and if I was hungry. His hair was black and coarse. He was wearing a baseball t-shirt and jeans covered in rust acrylic. As an Indian woman, I resist the urge to bleed out on a page, to impart the story of my drunken father. It was dangerous to be alone with him, as it was dangerous to forgive, as it was dangerous to say he was a monster. If he were a monster, that would make me part monster, part Indian. It is my politic to write the humanity in my characters and subvert the stereotypes. Isn't that my duty as an Indian writer? But what part of him was subversion? Our basement smelled like river water and cedar bough. He carved and painted endlessly in the corners of the room. While I sat in his lap, he taught me our icons. Eagle was mother, and bolts were thunder being, and his circles were the universes. It meant so much to draw a circle well. He practiced and let me watch. I remember when he left, my mother started to paint again. I remember that, while my father tried to draw a circle with his own eyes and hands, my mother used coffee cans. I resisted the iconography and found myself more interested in why Salish work wasn't true to life. My therapist asked me to speak to my father and mother in a session. I told my father that a bird is just a bird. A mother is a tangible thing. Making Indian women inhuman is a problem for me. We've become too symbolic and never real enough. My therapist asked me to speak to my mother, and I couldn't. My father was soft-looking sometimes. I liked to sleep in the crook of his neck. He smelled like Old Spice and bergamot. His hand shook when he was not drinking, at his worst. And when I held his hands, he seemed thankful. He delighted in my imagination. The grass was always high in our lawn, and he often let me use the hose to fill buckets and wash tires. I pretended it was a snake. My mother wanted to heal him. I remember several trips to visit him in rehab. She sent him to islands, and I remember wearing a life jacket, crossing water to somewhere in Tofino, British Columbia. I remember each hope given to me by my mother, that our father would be okay and things would be different. In the past, I wanted to tell her that some things can't be loved away, but I think she knew that. We left my father a few times. We stayed in my uncle's home. Mom took all four of us, along with my grandmother. We all slept in one room, and I had chicken pox. I slept in a green, upholstered chair and had an accident. My brother Ovilla was the only one awake. He told me to undress and took off his shirt for me to wear. I went back to sleep with a sour stomach and woke up as my father was forklifting me from the chair to his van. He always found us. Once, I packed my bags, mimicking my mother, with a bag of dolls and wooden cars. I told him I was leaving. I told him I would not come back until he stopped drinking. "Come here," he said. "No," I said. He promised me he would quit and then left. My brothers told me that he didn't really leave. I misremembered. My grandmother saved money and asked our cousin to kill my father. The man beat him well, and when my father came home, we were gone. He ruined every artwork we possessed. He tossed every can of salmon and beets that my grandmother had prepared for the winter. He took jewelry and money. When we got home, everyone told me to wait on the porch. They went inside and cleaned while I stared at my spit. For years, they were happy to let me imagine he left on his own regard. After my mother died, I went to find him. He lived in a town called Hope. He had a new family, and our van sat in his front lawn on bricks. When he answered the door, he told me he knew who I was. He had a thin, dirty white shirt on. He looked ill, and his face was gaunt. His hair was still black in some parts. His wife, Winnie, was my older sister's childhood friend. My father had met her when she was a girl, visiting my sister. After years with Ken, her front teeth were gone. She smiled at me and said my father had old videotapes of theater work I had done in the community. I had five new brothers, so young. They looked like the archetypes my own family had formed in the presence of my father. I found myself in the youngest child, who formed bonds too quickly and needed holding. My father and I sat across from each other in lawn chairs in his basement. I resisted the urge to sit poised like him. Instead, I held bad posture and slunk in my chair. You have my nose, he said. I said I missed him, feeling awful that it was true. The best thing I could do was leave. I know, I said. Your mother was a good woman. I told her I was an asshole, and she took me in, like a wounded bear. I know, I said. A month after this, he showed up at my house with a white documentary filmmaker. I answered the door, but could not let him in the house. My brother, Ovilla, was still scared of him, still angry and confused. They're doing a documentary about me, he said. About my art. I was anxious, standing there with him at my door. I know, he said. I'll go. I hugged him in my driveway. I know that the whole res was watching, even my sister, who knocked on my door after he left to look me in my eyes so I could see that I betrayed her. Even she, who was as tall as him and bigger, had to come to my door with backup. Even she was scared of him. I didn't know any better back then. The National Film Board of Canada debuted the documentary as a piece with immediacy and no external narrative. I'm a woman wielding narrative now, weaving the parts of my father's life with my own. I consider his work a testimony to his being. I have one of his paintings in my living room. Man Emerging is the depiction of a man riding a whale. The work is traditional and simplistic. Salish work calls for simplicity because an animal or man should not be convoluted. My father was not a monster, although it was in his monstrous nature to leave my brother and I alone in his van while he drank at the Kent. Our breaths became visible in the cold. Ken came back to bring us fried mushrooms. We took to the bar fare like puppies to slop. His smell was not monstrous, nor the crooks of his body. The invasive thought that he died alone in a hotel room is too much. It is dangerous to think about him, as it was dangerous to have him as my father, as it is dangerous to mourn someone I fear becoming. I don't write this to put him to rest, but to resurrect him as a man, when public record portrays him as a drunk, a monster, and a transient. I wish I could have known him as a child in his newness. I want to see him with the sheen of perfection, with skin unscathed by his mistakes or by his father's. It's in my nature to love him, and I can't love who he was, but I can see him as a child. Before my mother died, I asked her if he had ever hurt me. I put you in double diapers, she said. There's no way he hurt you. Did he ever hurt you? No, I said. If rock is permeable in water, I wonder what that makes me in all of this. There is a picture of my brother, Ovi, and me next to Dad's van. My chin is turned up, and at the bottom of my irises there is brightness. My brother has had his hand on his hip, and he looks protective standing over me. I know, without remembering clearly, that my father took this picture and that we loved each other. I don't think I can forgive myself for my compassion. 7. Little Mountain Woman. I feel like a squaw, the type white people imagine, a feral thing with greasy hair and nimble fingers, wanting. My earliest memories, and you, and the baby have turned earth in my body. I don't know what I am anymore. You have made me feel sick of myself. I killed a ladybug when we were walking, and you looked at me like I was wild. I am the mother of your son. I don't think you know how poor I used to be, that my house was infested with ladybugs for so long. My brother and I went mad when they wouldn't stop biting. We tried to swat them with brooms and towels. We tried to corner them. Their death smelled like a puddle and wouldn't leave our home. My mother didn't come home when the bugs overtook the living room. She was working 3 days on and 3 days off, and between that she was with Larry, my sister's father, who resurfaced in her life 20 years too late. just in time for my mother's midlife crisis. I don't think you know how poor that made me feel, a squaw child. I kill ladybugs whenever I see them. I know that the women you've loved wouldn't do that. They consider the things lucky. So much of the world shames me. I never get to say the full thing with you, like the ladybugs. I don't think you know how I feel, that having the baby didn't make things better. Before I went to the hospital, I drove to your home, at night. It was December and Messia. My moist hand stuck to your door. You pulled me in, and we stumbled to your couch. We sat for minutes in silence, beyond polite conversation, in the dark. I felt like a voyeur, staring at everything you owned. I wanted things to be mine, too. You wouldn't keep someone like me. I think you wanted the other women you were seeing, whole beings. My thighs were sweaty, and your heater was buzzing. The skin on my neck parted away from itself like arid soil. Your hands were holding themselves in your lap. You wore old clothes that stayed too long in the corners of your floor. You were dusty, and I liked that. You've said before that I'm mercurial. I don't know. Pain feels faster than light. I react to pain, and there's too much of it. In my first marriage, I was a teenager. I got married to leave my mother's house because foster care didn't work. I had aged out. I left to prove I could leave, and then I had Vito's baby. And then my mother died. I flew home to be in the room when they pulled the plug. He came with me, and we brought our son, Isidore. After her funeral, we stayed in my mother's duplex and packed her boxes. She had left the house I grew up in because it was infested with mold. During renovations, reckless kids broke in and, in some drunken dialogue, burned the house down. My ex-husband and I pushed each other, yelled at each other, and Isidore just rattled the gate at the stairway and sat in corners waiting for me. He was born gifted and moved silently throughout my world, unsure if he could trust me. He was a little ghost, like I was to my mother. Little ghosts don't carry little wounds. I think our pain expands the longer we're neglected. I got pregnant again by Vito. People have a right to think things will change. I allowed myself that much. The tips of your fingers felt like wet grapes. I wanted to bite everyone. I told you that I needed help, and you asked me to leave. A friend of yours had just taken his own life. It seemed unforgivable that I would be suicidal or wild when you needed me. I know at my worst I appear disposable, or that I make myself that way. My first husband kept me awake at night, knowing I had to work the next day. I argued until I fell asleep in bed, and he appeared above me with a knife. My blinds were open, and in the dark, I saw the moonlight catch his blade. He didn't speak to me. When I started to move, he left the room. The next day, I told him to leave, and then I begged him, and then I hit him hard enough to compel him to run. I committed myself after you asked me to leave. The nurses gave me a composition book and a ballpoint pen, the least I was ever given to write with, and I produced so much work. Every letter was to you. I don't think you know what your word meant to me. I found hundreds of ways to ask you if I was wrong. I tried to ask you, without your pride, was our problem your fault at all? Were you really cold, or do I just imagine people don't care about me? When I got out, I could read the dark. I turned the lights off in my kitchen and walked across the tiles. I had cleaned the room several times and it became lonelier as each speck was wiped clean. I felt absent without you or the dirt. Even my ghost left me. I wondered if your hands were still cold. You reminded me of a broken spring rocking horse, and I was all weight. Vito called the police after I hit him. I called my sister. When the cops came, they asked what I did to my husband. I wasn't sure. Isidore sat in my sister's lap. The officers asked me to show them my wrists. They reassured me that Vito had no marks where I had hit him, and that he would be fine. I pulled back my sleeves, and there were small, thin, red lines across my wrists. My sister cried and held her mouth. She had seen worse, and I expected more from her. I knew that cutting myself was wrong. I was pregnant and a mother. I reappeared in your life, and you were still seeing other women. I feel sick of myself when I consider my agency with you. A woman you liked played the banjo, the one with the gluten-free dog. When I feel like a squaw, I wash my face with alcohol, toner. There's never enough dirt to constitute the compulsion to clean myself or think I'm dirty. My ex-husband's family had an endless bankroll for lawyers and detectives, and I spent most of my pregnancy in court trying to retain custody of Isidore. You were in foster care? My lawyer asked. Yes. Can they use that against me? I asked. Everything is fair game. In moments like that, I remembered the ladybugs and mold. I remembered sour meat in the fridge and needing Mom to come home. I remembered what it was like to be nothing. She came home after 3 weeks once. I screamed at her for leaving my brother and me. I told her that I would take off with my boyfriend if she didn't change. She unplugged the landline phone so I couldn't call anyone and locked it in her bedroom with her padlock. I remember when she left, kicking down the door. I called a social worker who had been sniffing around. I was glad to bring the shame to our home. I was glad to expose her. What they didn't tell me was that I wouldn't see my brothers if I stayed in care. Maybe visits, my social worker told me when I asked. Before I turned 18, Child Protective Services let me go home after 4 different types of foster families. After I realized dysfunction was too well ingrained, I couldn't stand each family's specific type of awful or safe. A woman you liked left tennis balls at your place. I searched through your phone and found pictures of her dog. It was a small terrier with white fur. I don't know why she didn't send pictures of herself. I know that you liked that. How you fucked me then was degrading. I knew that when you were done, you were also finished with me. The other women, white women, were treated like good friends. I could have used that. One morning, I left your house, and you saw me later in public. You didn't stop to speak to me. You waved. Maybe I make myself the squaw. Maybe this whole time I should have sent you pictures of my hands. I was not the mother Isidore deserved. I was distant and kept to a routine so that there were no moments of candid and inexplicable love. I won in provincial court and supreme, and then we had a date for the Hague Convention. My lawyer tried to explain what it was. She told me a story about a woman who abducted her child from Ireland to escape her husband. The Hague Convention deported the child back to Ireland. What did the mother do? I asked. I think she moved back to Ireland. Isaiah didn't move in the womb. My doctor told me some babies were quiet and lazy. The things you said to your white women, I wanted that. I slouched and inhaled shorter breaths to take up less space around you. I understood I had sacred blood. But what would that mean to a white man like you? I know. I know the tenses and the syllables of every rite and had spent hours with women who made medicine. I wasn't made to be ornamental, but it's what I wanted. I inherited black eyes and a grand regal grief that your white women won't own or carry. I don't think you know how I felt. And I wondered what my grief looked like to you. I went into labor alone in the hospital. I gave birth alone, I held Isaiah in my arms. When my lawyer said Isidore would be taken away soon, deported back to the U.S., Isaiah was in my arms. I don't understand. I have my baby, I said. I told them they would be separating brothers and about your culture, and no one said you were unfit, my lawyer said. What happened? Isidore was born in America, and Vito said that he was coerced into leaving with you and his son to Canada. The convention is international. That's a concern. What about this boy? I asked. They don't seem interested yet, she said. I went back to get my earrings from your house and saw you holding your Laura in the doorway. I still knocked. You told me to come back later. How many times did I go back before I got pregnant? When did I become enough for you, and what was the distinction? It would help to know what makes me worthwhile, and what doesn't. I sent Isidore Hot Wheels cars in the mail. I cradled Isaiah and couldn't look at him. I wasn't sure if I had a right to be a mother if I had no right to have Isidore. It didn't make sense. My therapist guided me and showed me how to hold Isaiah. She made me look him in the eyes and explained he wasn't bonded to me. He averted his gaze when I was close, as if I were a monster. I know I am a squaw. Social workers offered me respite. Time away from my baby. I used the time to drink. I didn't think it was possible to be fortunate enough to be a mother again. Isaiah cried all night, and I remembered well that I held a hand over his mouth, long enough for me to know I am a horror to my baby. Nobody wanted him for those split seconds. And I wondered why the people who should be punished the most aren't punished, because they hurt children who don't matter. After those seconds of postpartum depression or grief or terror, I took the transgression to healers and social workers and therapists. They absolved me. What else do they expect from someone like me, I thought. One woman, the director of the health department, said I was a tiger cornered in a room. My circumstance was a cage. My marriage was a prodding thing, and my baby was still my cub. I don't excuse myself even when the analogies align. I was lucky to get a ride into town to give birth, and social workers had to drive Isaiah and me home from the hospital. I often looked at him and wondered if we existed. I answered the question by saving my checks and taking night classes. I answered the question by leaving the reservation for any other place. Someone offered to share an apartment in El Paso, in the desert. I went. I can't believe my reserve of water, from my nose and eyes. I have dormant fluid in my body. Every woman does. I don't know if I am a cavern or a river. Once you said I was a geyser, a hole in the ground bursting. Pain is faster than light, and I wish people would not fault me for things I can't forget or explain. When I became pregnant, your women fell away. Your fingers were less edible. I had our baby boy, remembering the women and my sons. White women have always made me feel inferior, but I don't think you know how much. All you see is me killing ladybugs or crying or asking you what I did. You can't know the spite of my feelings. I sold everything to come to America. My ex-husband's Beanie Babies, which his mother asked for in the divorce, my wedding ring, my bike, my mother's broken car and her winter jackets. I made the active choice that my son and I were real. I held him while I cooked, and I didn't clean very often so I could keep him in my arms. He fit well on my hip and learned to keep his small hands inside the neck of my shirt for comfort. He asked for bottles by putting his fingers in my mouth. He became expressive. He laughed at everything. We saw each other more than the world could see. You and I compare hurt. I only feel dirty every day and some nights. I washed my face 3 or 4 times, and when I told you I wanted to be poreless, you told me people should have pores. I feel dormant watching you live fuller than I can. I worry I am a cavern. I have inherited my mother's hollow stomach. You tell me that my pain feels searing and that I'm missing 4 layers of skin. Your pain is an empty room. I agree. When I was 11, I stared in the mirror to see if I had breasts yet. Fred Cardinal, an elder, was in the next room. He called me in and said, "Your name is Little Mountain Woman, Asini Wachi Esquisis." I felt ashamed and undeserving of the name. He wanted me to know that I was good and holy, but I didn't think that my body was a universe. I didn't think I would unravel so well either. I drew power from the mountains and chose a home in the desert. When we got married, the officiant said it would be hard. In marriage, swollen and postpartum, I stared at our bed, which was held up by books. I wanted to fix it. I stripped the bed more often than you liked. We washed the sheets. I stared at the doorway where you held another woman once, and I saw myself on the other side, a squaw. I washed my face again and again and considered that if you knew more about my pain, I might feel less of it. I think you imagined I was sacred before you used me. My heart has an extra chamber now. I am more fragile than you know, more squaw and ornamental. I can turn my chin and pose like a figurine. I wonder how much you can know about being used. Can you wash me like a saint? From squaw to mother with a face and pores and a body and my own good history. I want my large heart, but older and safer and clean. Can't you wash me? Or hollow me out for good? Wash me in my own regard and pain and let me dry out. Let me kill every ladybug and laugh when I do. Don't leave me. I can't bear to lose my sons or any more of myself or you. 8. Believing deficit. It's strange that when I was scared to lose you, I chose to leave you first. I left you and went to Barbara's. We exchanged gifts before I tell her why I left. I give her a handcrafted silver ring wrapped in a mustard cloth. She presents me with a sweet grass braid as long as my arm, still wet from the braiding. The gifts are ritual and plenty. Yellow roses and basil plants and tobacco and books we like and things for ceremony. She thinks my husband doesn't understand how to communicate love, and I think he's impotent. "White men," Barbara says. His anger just wells into nothing. We give different theories to each other and conclude that maybe he's not the problem. Maybe there's no problem and I can't deal with that. Every time I leave, my husband says that he can't make me stay. "Can't you?" I think every time. My mother and I found an eagle carcass on our way to the river. With the feathers plucked, we saw its sinewy skin. "White men," Mom said. Feathers are a gift and flexible protein. Mom put down tobacco and ran her fingers over its exposed parts. She told me the salmon run was coming, and this bird would have wanted for nothing. She wanted me to see the deficit white people leave. Nobody wants to know why Indian women leave or where they go. Our bodies walk across the highway from the dances of our youth into missing narratives without strobe lights or sweet drinks in our small purses, or the talk of leaving. The truth of our leaving or coming into the world is never told. While my ancestors' bones laid proud and dull in the grave or on display, mine were hot, light, ready to go. Larry was my mother's worst boyfriend. He came into my life when I was 16. He started to walk across the halls naked. I thought he was a walking corpse. He played a ghost, looming between my mother and me. He went to the kitchen and never ate, His insides were rot. Drunks can't eat after a point. He drove me to school holding a beer can, a tangible thing in his unstable hand. My mother didn't believe me, so it was always an unreal taking. He touched me to help me get out of the car. I searched for irrefutable things to tell my mother. None of it compared to the days they went clamming together or collected Devil's Club in the valley. My mother never liked the beach until Larry came around with his rake and gloves. They waded in gloomy water as I watched from the truck. They seemed content. It didn't matter if he groped me. It didn't matter if he groped my cousin. None of that mattered. I told my mother that she might half stop drinking before I was born, but she was still a drunk. She stopped bringing Larry home. Instead, they went to his place in the city. There were only so many places where men like him could live. I took a bus there to find her. I saw my mother differently. Larry lived on the first floor in what I thought was a drug house. Women, girls like me, sat outside on couches with babies, stood inside the hallway, and made tea in the kitchen. I knocked on his bedroom door. My mother was ashamed, under the covers in his bed. She rummaged through her purse and handed him $20. "Here," he said, "go back to the res. This is how we go missing. This is how we decide to leave." I left on Valentine's Day after the dance. The hall wasn't decorated. The girls and I stood in circles in strobe lights and had sweet drinks in our small purses, and we had my talk of leaving. "Fuck it," Lucy said. "Don't come back." Lucy was shorter than all the Chehalis girls, but she walked up to them anyway to start shit. We left, drunk, and went out along the highway. The trucks honked at our silhouettes. Nobody wants to know how we leave. I only had one bag to pack, and I didn't have money. My boyfriend Vito let me live with him in his mother's home. It was better than foster care. His whole family was large and Republican. I acclimated from my Marxist-Leninist mother to their lifestyle. We ate top sirloin and fried shrimp, and Bush became the president again. They asked me to vote and drove me to the polling station, and I went in and stood there long enough. Every day was like that for me. I called my mother to show her I could leave. "What are you going to do?" she asked. "Not be there," I said. "Where are you?" she asked. When a man's hands become a ghost, there is no way to strip them from a body. Haunting, what a mother does not see. Native women walk alone from the dances of our youth into homes they don't know for the chance to be away. Their silhouettes walk across highways and into cars at night. They are troubled by nothing but the chance that they might have to come back someday to bury their mothers. My mother died on Thanksgiving. My brother was watching the Texas Chainsaw Massacre in the next room. Larry was already dead from liver failure. I flew in from a place far removed. I worked for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. I prayed over her body and touched her delicate skin. A bloat protruded from her neck, and I felt that too. I felt the deficit. I took her house and its contents and let her ghost in. The people said to put away the pictures, but I didn't. They said to cover the mirrors, but I didn't. The ritual of death was not interesting, and then I left her home again. I found humor in leaving. I punctured a friend's chest with a fork. He heard me when I said no. Another dug his knuckles into me. I didn't cover the marks. He gave me his credit card, and I bought diamonds and hammered silver. Another I left in the waiting room of his lawyer's office. He wanted to prove he didn't sleep with a student of his. The lie detectors, and his guilt, were enough for me. He gave me my first STD. He gave me $3,000, and I bought summer classes. When I graduated, he asked for a picture, but I didn't reply. Another, I left in Miami. He didn't think I was like that, but I was clearly like that. I only smiled at room service. "What do you want?" I asked men, like an indictment. Another has white guilt and thinks it's progress to bind me. Can you say all you want from me in one breath? I asked. Barbara asks what I get in leaving. I tell her that my husband left me in the hospital once before we were married. I guess I took him back to leave him. He visited me in the hospital for finality. Suicidal ideation troubled him too much. I asked if he felt culpable. There was a crafted tree on the walls for the sick women, made of paper and crayon and glue. The tree had leaves, 30 different colors, with words on them, like intelligent, smart, brave, bold, strong. Casey pointed to sexy. I put the leaf in my pocket and used it as a bookmark for a year. Barbara tells me to go back. He doesn't hit me, she says. He's intelligent. We have a baby. The wet, sweet grass she braided is dry and straight. She puts it below the windshield in my car, and when I drive back, I'm not sure I will stay. Her house is a lot of old pictures and plants and draped scarves. A blue budgie sings in her office, and there are a few old drums around. It is everything of my mother and home. I hold my sons at night, and they are so still, like rocks. I run my fingers over their foreheads and wonder how they don't collect dust. Boys asleep, and I am a rare carcass in the river, bloated with deficit. Every time I see wings flap, I think of leaving. It used to feel like breaking vertigo, and now it is just breaking. Now that I stay, we have the same fight. I'm trying not to be an asshole, you say. Sometimes trying to be the absence of something makes you that very thing. I understand I am talking about myself and leaving. We can sit together for hours with the deficit, and it's not unusual anymore. It's ritual. Us both, trying to be the absence of something and forgiving each other for the children we have become. I think about my mother, knee-deep in the beach with a rake, smiling at Larry. I think about myself in the back of the truck, needing her. And after all of this, there are still rocks in the old home I grew up in, the home that burned down. There are still lava sweat lodge rocks sitting underneath grass that overgrew a fire pit. There is some stillness, even in my history. A good secret in so much bad. It almost feels like a betrayal to have good thoughts. Sometimes I know part of me is still a ghost. Walking next to my mother, looking for something to make an offering to, holding her hand. Either this feeling means that part of me is dead, or that she's alive, somewhere inside of me. 9. Thunder Being, Honey Bear. I avoid the mysticism of my culture. My people know there is a true mechanism that runs through us. Stars were people in our continuum. Mountains were stories before they were mountains. Things were created by story. The words were conjurers, and ideas were our mothers. Thunder is contrary. Thunder can intuit, and her action is the music caused by lightning. She comes because we ask, and that's why falling apart is holy. People said I came from thunder. I thought the quick chaos was my master. My dreams were about a spinning wheel, symbols of an unstoppable force that would ruin me. I was a child when I told my mother there was a large wheel in my dreams. She asked me what I did when I saw it. I watched it, I said. She looked at me carefully that day. She took out her paints and drew a thunderbird on a white poster board. Before the paint dried, I put my finger on its blue chest. When I got my period, she gave me a Waterford crystal heart. I wore it like my brother wore his medicine bundle, around the neck and under the shirt. It felt like a new organ. In a coffee shop, I couldn't catch my breath and doubled over with pain. I remembered a man in the shower. I went outside. Closing my eyes only disoriented me further from the world, and holding on to things made me feel too connected, receptive to every fiber or bench or tree. I called Casey. I wondered if he thought this was a real emergency or another dramatic thing. I am constantly in some panic or despair, it seems. I worried more than I could breathe. What do I do with my hands, I thought. What do I do with my eyes, which felt obscene in the light? Thunder can awaken one's soul, even the atheist without. We have clowns in my culture, who carry a subversive nature. When women wail, or when they won't speak, a clown will throw its snot, or contort its body to point to how absurd our pain is, or how pointless it is to try to contain it. That contrary nature can awaken the dead. I thought about my mother's body, weak. My father's body, jaundice. His pubic mound was black, and beneath the steam and soap, I can smell him. Years away, I can smell him. I covered my nostrils. I remembered showering with my father more than once, and I remembered my fear of breathing. I had a new knowledge or memory, and knew to be ashamed. The truth sometimes doesn't appear exact but approximate. I knew my own fingers and my father's were shameful. I remembered in the coffee shop something so brief and kinetic that I didn't want to be in my body. My father, in the bathroom, had asked me to shower with him when I was 5 or 6. Things connect with the right conduit. One right memory had been absent. As a child, I had drawn in my journal a male figure, naked. My mother was shocked, so I told her a friend had drawn it. I was forbidden from going to the girl's house again, and my mother explained to me that men hurt children. They're capable. "What Michelle drew," she said, "is not right." She called Michelle's parents, and I remember thinking how right the drawing was. How I scaled each limb and part well enough that the girl next to the man appeared small, and her smile was not a real smile, but a sign. My mother, she believed my lie easily, without question. Not one. Thunder Being made me feel like I had forgotten 10,000 irons plugged in. I couldn't go home. I could only let things burn while I looked at my hands. My husband held my shoulders. "I don't know what to do with my hands," I said. A graduate student approached us and ignored my eyes. I felt more present than I ever had, and invisible. It was Thunder Being's game, or a gift of memory. This is more than simple traumatic stress, or me, open and gawking at my true misery. I was the third generation of the things we didn't talk about. Casey and I went to the car. "Do you want a margarita?" he asked. My husband, 6'4", large head, large blue eyes, hapless, and already acclimated to the chaos of me. My calls and my anxiety and the idea that I might never be okay were acceptable by now, usual. "It's okay to not be okay," a mentor had said to me once. I held the armrest of the car, looking outside like a child, waiting for my body to feel organic again, like when I'm teaching, bouncing around the room with an agenda. At 32, I was a child, a victim of something. I saw his pubic mound in my mind. I was afraid of what that meant, afraid that I might remember clearly what happened. I made a life out of naming things, and I couldn't speak this. "I need to see someone about this," I said. The therapist tapped my kneecaps, one and then the other. I closed my eyes. "What's your safe space?" she asked. Her office was small. She was licensed just enough to deal with my trauma, but not educated beyond my comprehension. She was not so smart that I would worry what she was writing in her notebook. Her hair was short. She scared me with her aura, as someone who believed in God and would have me believe too if I wasn't mindful. My safe space is outside my childhood home. Outside in the yard, overlooking 40 acres of corn. I liked the whistle of the stalks and loneliness. There were only coyotes in the field and crows and wild things, weaving through dry stalks. My eyes moved back and forth as she tapped me, left and right. I felt like a pendulum or something open, steady and drawing to a time, ready to greet some horrible memory beneath the safety.